Why don't we begin? Thank everyone for coming. Take this opportunity, of course, to thank our hosts, the Raskises, for opening up their beautiful home. Thank Ellie Lassen and Pam Lehman for their help in the coordination. And once again, we take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, Golda Shear Aaron and her brother, Dr. Charles Steinberg, who are sponsoring this series in memory of their father, Dr. Leon Steinberg's first Yahrzeit, and Neshama should have an Aliyah. You'll turn to the first page. The title of our talk for this evening in particular is Abortion and the Status of Potential Life. We began last week this series that's focusing on medical technology and its impact on the sanctity of life by discussing some of the creative ways and technologies that we can now help infertile couples conceive. And the question was what the status of some of those activities were. And again, there's so many of those that we didn't even get into, but we just discussed particularly one method of artificial insemination. But things such as in vitro fertilization and even let alone the specter of human cloning, obviously raise many, many questions that relate to status and sanctity of life as we think about the creative process of life. Moving slightly forward in that process, not by a long shot, only by at most 9 months, I wanted to discuss this evening the topic of potential life, whether Judaism recognizes such a notion, and what the status of that life is, and whether it whether it merits some of this, some if not all of the same protection and sanctity that life would otherwise do. We mentioned this morning in the sermon how unfortunately there's another part of the world or another religion that has accepted what we could call unfortunately the culture of death. Perhaps it's not a surprise then that their arch enemy is the Jewish people, because on an ideological level we have always been literally just the opposite. We're a culture that celebrates and sanctifies life. I didn't mention in the sermon, I forgot, but what I should have mentioned, of course, is a perfect illustration of this, is how for us, even though sometimes not only death a part of life, but sometimes it's even a required part of life, but nevertheless, our attitude towards death perhaps is best illustrated by the fact that the archetype, the source of all tumah in the world, all purity and impurity in the world, is death. Death is a source of tumah. Everything, all the very technical halachos, which are difficult to learn in Rishnayas, or even to hear read about to a certain extent when we read those parshios in the Torah, they're all, if you trace it back, they're all steps away from that via vosa tumah, which is a dead body. So we are very, very, very sensitive to and very take very seriously the sanctity of life. And what I want to discuss this evening is the question of what the status is of a pregnant woman, again, not her status per se, but the status of the fetus, even the baby, if you'll call it that, who's growing inside of her. This, of course, is unlike some of the issues we discussed last week, which are really only brand new because of the technology has only been relatively new. Abortion, in its most crudest sense, has been around since the beginning of time. There's always been a very crude way to terminate pregnancies. It's obviously, as we'll see shortly, discussed even in Chumash. So it's not a new procedure, although obviously the way and the method that it's done when necessary or when elected to be done is certainly very new, and that's constantly changing, as all medical procedures are. But it's not a new story. In America, of course, it became a major issue in the early 1960s. Two particular cases that can be pointed to. One was in 1962. There was an Arizona woman who, we'll get back to some of these general examples even later, but at the time she took the infamous tranquilizer of thalidomide. But anywhere between 6,000 and 7,000 babies were born deformed from women who had taken this drug. And at the time, Arizona prohibited abortions. And she went to a number of other states, none of whom allowed her to, at the time, have an abortion. And she ended up going to Sweden, where she had an abortion, and when they eventually obviously removed the body of the baby, it actually confirmed that it would have been born without any hands or legs. That was a big issue in 1962. And then a very closely related problem was the German measles epidemic in 1964. Many thousands of babies born deformed, stillborn, and those women who had been exposed to or contracted it were very, very nervous, and some of them, fearing the consequences, very much elected to abort. The first state to really start going forward with laws to completely make abortion legal and without reservation was Colorado in April of 1967. That was followed by North Carolina, California. I was curious what our own state of Maryland did. That was 1968. And eventually, of course, this culminated in the famous case of Roe v. Wade in 1973. That makes three important things for 1973: the Yom Kippur War, my birthday, and Roe v. Wade. All 1973. On a political level, as you know, I mean, this is something that is still being waged literally to this very day in the United States. Certainly not going to get into the constitutional issues, well out of my area of expertise. And even from the perspective, as we mentioned last week, of comparative religion, we do see some other perspectives. Of course, the most vocal and well-known one is of the Catholic Church, that views even potential life to be endowed with the absolute equal sanctity of actual life, and therefore, by logical extension, any abortion under any circumstances to be tantamount to murder. There are other churches that are more moderate, and there are certainly even some churches which are incredibly liberal when it comes to the question of abortion. There's definitely a range within the Christian community on that. But certainly the most well-known and vocal opinion is that of the Catholic Church. I could give you chapter and verse. Virtually every pope that's ever had an opportunity has spoken about this. The previous pope, John Paul, made this one of his crusades, and there's actually some very moving and powerful speeches that he gave to that cause of what is known as the pro-life cause. So what is the Jewish view? What is the Jewish view? I'll tell you, if you look at general media reports or even popular culture, I think there's a tremendous confusion. It should not at all, again, I'm not going to get remotely into the political issue, although obviously there's an extension. One could give a second class on some what our attitude should be towards Roe v. Wade as a political minority living in the United States. I think that's a very complicated question. I do not think it's a simple one at all. But in that culture, it's not at all, I shouldn't say, I don't know if it's surprising, unfortunately it's not surprising, and, is that it seems well disproportionate to our numbers. The vocal leaders of the who are supportive of pro-choice are actually disproportionately Jewish. Whether it's leaders of some of the national women's groups, Abe Foxman and the ADL, and others who are very, very much on the forefront. Numerous examples, which I don't even care to mention, in popular culture or in entertainment, where not only are personalities in their, quote, real life, the leader of this, I mean, even in theatrical or other types of performances where there's often a contrast between the Jewish character and the non-Jewish character, and it's always the Jewish character who, of course, is pro-choice. I remembered from a few years ago a very, very excellent article, and with the abilities and technology of the internet, I was able to just Google it, and in a few seconds call it up yesterday, and that was written by actually a Baltimorean, originally a native Baltimorean, Rabbi Avi Shafran. His father, of course, is still a rabbi here in town, and he is one of the head machers of the World Aguda. So what occasioned his article, he's written numbers of articles on this, in general he's a very articulate writer, was a particular bill at the time, this is going back 2 years, 2.5 years ago, that President Bush was involved in, which was the partial birth abortion ban, a topic which we're not going to get into directly tonight, a partial birth abortion, although you'll see very shortly that it'll be indirectly related to some of these we'll discuss. But that was a particular issue with the type of abortion which is done typically late term, and usually some, if not all, of the baby, including perhaps part of the baby's head, is already actually taken out of the woman's body before the baby is killed. So, needless to say, it's more gruesome than typical, and therefore, relatively speaking, at least less popular. What occasioned that Rabbi Shafran's piece was not the legislation, but the reaction to the legislation, and specifically, and I still remember, I was hoping somebody would write about this, because I remember when I was reading the reports, I was so upset by reading it, not just that there were particular Jewish groups that were against the legislation, which I personally would disagree with them anyway on that, but that's fine. You can make a general political argument for that, but specifically the formulation of it. And I remember being so happy that Rabbi Shafran had appreciated that. I'll just give you a little snippet of his piece, which I think is a good way of kind of opening and setting the issue of what the Jewish approach is. If you look, he mentions here... with his typically sharp pen, the president of Hadassah, June Walker. Now, why the president of Hadassah should be weighing in on this, so that's a problem. But okay, so she appointed herself an expert not only in all things political, but even in all things Jewish. And she opined, and this is a quote, I remember reading this quote well before I read Rabbi Shaffrin's piece, all about how she was terribly against the bill because it undermined Jewish values. Because Jewish values, not political pragmatism, but Jewish values support the position of being against such an idea. Why? Quote, because the preservation of a woman's health is the standard in determining when an abortion is permissible. And we'll have to remember that quote as we move along in the shir. But for now, suffice it to look at the next line. What does Rabbi Shaffrin write? She grievously misleads. To be sure, the Talmudic sources are clear that if the life of a pregnancy-endangered Jewish mother takes precedence over her unborn child, then there's no way to preserve both lives. And while the matter is not free from controversy, there may even be rabbinic opinions that allow abortion when the pregnancy seriously jeopardizes the mother's health. But those narrow exceptions do not translate into some unlimited mother's, quote, right to make her own reproductive choices, which is the upshot of Roe v. Wade, which Hadassah enthusiastically endorses. So there's a lot in that one paragraph. Much of it I'm not going to get into even indirectly. But I think it sets the stage for the fact, and again, I could give you other examples, whether it's in more serious news pieces or, as I say, even in some entertainment issues, where you see there's this general perception in the Jewish world that the whole notion of this idea of the right to choose, etc., is it not just something that the Jews should pragmatically embrace because it protects our interests, but that is itself a Jewish value. And I think Rabbi Shaffrin argues very eloquently that that's a mistake. So who's right? So that's what I want to discuss tonight. That's what I want to study and see where it comes out of. As we did last week, I want to first see some of the basic core primary sources that we have, in this case starting already from the Chumash, and then we'll launch into some of the more contemporary and recent shuvas that discuss different approaches to this topic. So if you take a look, the only time this is really mentioned in the Chumash is actually in Sefer Shmos and Parakid Aleph, where the following story is told to us. If two men are fighting, and one of them, whether it's accidentally, not trying to hurt the woman, but one of them, not the husband, the other man, hits or bumps into this woman, and basically she miscarries, unfortunately kills this child. And there isn't some other catastrophe. What that means, as Rashi explains, is that the mother herself didn't die. We're not talking about the case where the mother died, only the miscarriage. So what is the halacha, says the Chumash? Anosh ye anosh. This man shall surely be punished. Kasher yashis alav bal isha. V'nosan bisflilim. There is a financial penalty that will be determined by the judges that he has to pay for aborting this fetus. However, says the pasuk, the im ason yiyeh, which again, as Rashi says, means, but if, God forbid, something had happened, if the woman had died, then yiyeh v'nasata nefesh tachas nefesh. Then it would be a capital case, and this man would be tried for murder. So, what is the clear implications of this pasuk is a tremendous contrast. Again, in both cases, it was accidental, but what is this? Is it a capital offense or not? And the Chumash seems to be very clear of a contrast. When, unfortunately, Nebuch, only the child is aborted, so then that is a financial penalty. That it's not even clear if it was usur. Was there an aveira done? Let me ask you a question. If I accidentally run and, you know, skip the curb and plow my car right into this beautiful bay window, so I know they're asking this is a lot of money, but did I do an aveira? Not necessarily. I did damages. I'm going to have to pay them back. So here all the Torah says is that you've done damages. You could crudely say you've damaged their property. So you owe them a financial remuneration. You have to pay them back. But certainly there's a tremendous contrast with if, God forbid, something had happened to the mother. So then there we could be potentially talking about accidental. Not accidental, but we're at least talking about dina nefashos, a capital crime. Even if it's accidental, it still may be a capital crime. So there's a strong contrast that the Chumash seems to perhaps be outlining for us. Perhaps the most well-known of the primary legal sources that we have is the famous Mishnah in Maseches Halos. That's the following source, where the Mishnah talks about the woman who is having a very difficult pregnancy. Isha shehi maksha lele. She's having a very difficult pregnancy, and the implications are, as the Mepharshim understand it, her life is at risk. This can happen, certainly in antiquity, it was happened even more commonly, but even to this day, such a thing could happen. What does the Mishnah tell you? What do you do? Very graphically, mechatchen es havlad b'meah. You can, literally, you can cut up the baby in her womb And then you literally, you can extract it limb by limb, which is, again, leave aside the graphic nature. Bottom line is you're allowed to intentionally abort the baby in order to save the mother's life. Why? Because her life comes before the fetus's life. However, says the Mishnah, that's only one side of the story. Yotza Ruba, what if it's now the baby's in labor? And most of the baby's body has already emerged. Or as the Rambam and others have an alternative girsa, and we assume that halakhically these are equivalents, even if most of the body is still in the baby, in the mother's body, but the head of the baby has emerged. Rosho or Rubo. Either way, that's already emerged. And now the doctors are saying, oh my gosh, blood pressure's dropping. Horrible catastrophe right before our eyes. The mother seems to be slipping away. And somehow, in such a case, if they kill the baby, that will somehow save the mother. Says the Mishnah, Ein Noginba. You're not allowed to do that. Nebuch, you have to let the mother die. You're not allowed to touch the baby. Why? Shein Dochin Nefesh Miptein Nefesh. Because we don't play games of choosing when it comes to two lives. Who said that her life is any more important than her baby's life? As a PS on an emotional level, I don't know almost any woman who wouldn't tell you, take care of the baby, don't worry about me. But that's an emotional issue. Most women would say, I'll sacrifice my life for my baby. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's halakhically. As it so happens, that is halakhically endorsed. The Mishnah says we wouldn't make that choice. And what's the difference between the first case of the Mishnah and the second case of the Mishnah? One case, the baby is still in utero. And apparently it has a different status, because in the first case we say we do choose the mother's life first. So apparently something happens even when the baby is only partially born, which changes and elevates the status of the child, not just to potential life, but to actual life. 100% high, the baby is not even a minute old. Doesn't matter. Even less than a minute old. But someone who's actually a full-fledged human being has absolutely equivalent status with anybody else. You know, sometimes we think about viability, right? Could you just leave? Maybe that baby's not even viable. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Baby equal status. And again, the Mishnah hints at such a language, hints at it by using the language of, right, only in the second part of the Mishnah does the Mishnah talk about both of them as a nefesh. Literally translated as a soul or a fully dignified human being. Once you have that status, which only apparently occurs when the baby is at least partially born, so then there is absolute equivalency. On the other hand, there is an implication that that status does not exist while the baby is in utero. That is, if you will, to use a lazy term, if you will, the liberal implication of the Mishnah. But there's also, if you will, a conservative implication, which you didn't necessarily get from the Chumash. But what do you see from this? Which is that, in certain cases at least, absent the health of the mother being a concern, right, what's the specific case of the Mishnah? Where the woman's life is a danger. So apparently you need some tremendously mitigating factor in order to permit it, even in utero. Now again, the Mishnah is not saying explicitly, but it's not a huge leap to say that if it's just a question of convenience, it may not be allowed even when the baby's fully in utero. Now what's the problem? So we don't know yet. If you would kill a baby when the baby's already halfway out, that would be murder. It's clearly not murder, or at least it would appear from the Mishnah when the baby's fully in utero. However, it doesn't necessarily mean it's allowed either. So that's a little bit of the ambiguity that comes from this source. A Gemara, which is clearly informed by this source, is the next piece you have here. It also has a Mishnah and a Gemara. It's a very fascinating one. Very, very fascinating. And really shows you, I think, in this source itself, it's so complicated and how complex the Jewish approach is. If you look at the Mishnah teaches us a tragic case. What if you have a woman who's pregnant? She's also chayav misa. She's also guilty of a capital offense, and she has to be killed. And we know that Judaism actually takes the exact opposite approach to the death penalty as contemporary America, and that is we rush to the death penalty. All right, so we look for every possible excuse not to employ it. But when that is exhausted, when there's a shock, this person is chayav misa, so not only do we not delay it, in fact, delay is considered usur, it's considered cruel. There's no such thing as sitting on death row for years in Jewish law. If we're going to kill you, we kill you really without any delay. The question is, what if she's pregnant? Right? Women on death row is a big sensitive topic in America. A pregnant woman on death row? So says the Mishnah, Isha Shiyasa Lahareg, Ein Mamtinan La Achatelet. We don't wait. We don't say, let her wait 6 months. At most, 9 months, we don't wait. We would kill her, and obviously that would imply the baby as well. However, Haisha, she yashva la mashmer. Again, it's my own illustration, but to me it's not so far-fetched. If she's pregnant anyway, and then she hears the verdict of the dayanim guilty, that kind of tension could throw someone into labor. So let's say now they want to kill her, but she's in labor. Yashva la mashmer, she's on the birth stool. There the Mishnah says, well, once she's already in labor, mamtina la shetela. That rush, we can wait. Right, you can imagine a woman's last hours in life are in labor. She might be begging to be killed first. I don't know. Right? But in such case, we would wait, and only then afterwards we would kill her. Commenting on this halacha in the Mishnah, the Gemara says in the next paragraph, why? Why do we wait when she's already taking the second case? Why do we wait if she's in labor? Kaven de akar, once the baby is moving, meaning is trying to leave the mother, Gufa acharina hu. It's considered a separate body. By implication, perhaps, before labor, baby is considered what? Part of the mother's body. Now Rabbi Yehuda says something incredible. Ha'isha ha'yotza le'harek, second line. When we said that we're not going to wait, we're not going to let her have the baby, it's worse, if you will, than that, or more extreme than that. We don't just say, we'll kill her, and then memela, automatically, by killing her, the baby will die prematurely. We intentionally inflict death upon the baby first. We give her a smack on the stomach, says the Mishnah. Why would we do such a thing? Isn't that a bizarre thing to do? Says the Gemara, because the thought is that if you would kill her, so it's bad enough, but then if she then has a stillborn or something afterwards, after she's already dead, then who knows what blood or other things might come out of her as the baby unfortunately has died. And that would be considered somehow degrading to her. As we're so sensitive to her kavod, yet this is unbelievable. We're so sensitive to her kavod that we're going to kill her, but we want her to kill her in a way that's dignified. And since this baby would otherwise die, the question is whether the baby should die as she as or after she dies, or 10 minutes or 5 minutes before that, beforehand. The difference being, if we do that, so then in a sense, whatever blood or else there is, that would be clean up, so to speak, right, nice, and then we'll kill her. Says the Gemara, that's preferred. Again, here you have, instead, again, we're not thinking in those terms in the Gemara, but in essence, an abortion, you're killing a baby in utero. For what purpose? Just to save this woman who's otherwise already guilty of a capital offense a little embarrassment. Not exactly the most noble reason. And yet, nevertheless, that's what's done according to the halacha. Finally, the Gemara concludes with another case where it speaks about a woman who is in labor and then she dies. Not only she dies before the baby's born. And the Gemara tells us that even though the baby's still in utero, we would be mechal al Shabbos, we would desecrate Shabbos. Even, says the Gemara at the end, lahavi stocking der chusarab, even if it's a violation, not a small, minor rabbinic violation, but an averu, we would be mechal Shabbos midaraisa. We'd even carry through the streets without an eruv in order to take, the Gemara here is talking about a knife, to do a cesarean section, in order to save the baby's life. So on the one hand, now the point being, let me flesh that out, I'm sorry, the point being, ordinarily, we do not allow Chilul Shabbos on a Torah level, on a Daraisa level, except for one exception. Pikuach Nefesh, saving a life. So if the Gemara concludes, this is why this is such a complex Gemara, if the Gemara concludes that we will move Chilul Shabbos on a Torah level to save this fetus, what is the implications of that statement? That this is, on a very real level, a living person who we want to save. But that's coming on the heels of a Gemara 2 lines earlier, which just told us that we're even willing to abort the baby for a cause as minor as, relatively minor as, the covet of this guilty woman. That would seem to me to point in a much different direction. That whatever the general problem of abortion is, it's not so great, because obviously the bar is not that high that we can easily overcome it with this relatively minor reason. So just in this Gemara itself, I would say, conflicting impressions, certainly very, very complicated. Let's look at two more Gemaras and some opinions of the basic Rishonim, and then we'll be really, you'll have all the building blocks you need. And then anytime you ever go to a shiur, ever read an article, you'll already know everything. Everything else is going to flow from a few more sources that we still have to see. So the next two are sources from the tractate Sanhedrin, from Gemara and Sanhedrin. Here the Gemara tells us the following, the last source on the front of your page. Gemara tells us, again, this is a Gemara that's getting back to the Mishnah that we had seen. The woman is pregnant, and it's a danger to her life. And there the Gemara, remember the Mishnah had told us, we distinguish between whether the head or the majority of the body had emerged or not. So look at the last line here where I have it underlined. Yotza rosho ein noginbo. So first we assume, which is what the Mishnah had told us in Ahalos, once the baby's head comes out, we don't touch the baby. Why? Because we don't choose. Why? Who said the mother's life is any more or less valuable than the baby's? We just have to let nature take its course. That's what the Mishnah told us. We saw that before. So the Gemara here is dealing with the context of a halakha called rodef. A rodef is a guy's chasing you down the street, about to shoot you. You don't have to wait. You don't even have to hope he misses. You can take a year gun and you can shoot him. And that's a mitzvah. I guess a mitzvah for other people to do it to save your life. Why? That's the halakha of rodef, the pursuer. Someone is pursuing you, you don't have to wait. You're allowed to be preemptive when your life is reasonably in danger. So if that's the case, says the Gemara, Fa'amai, Rodefu, why don't we say if the baby's head is out, you can't touch the baby? The baby is a Rodef. The baby's running after the mother trying to kill her. If this baby would be 10 years old and running after, you know, a little bit of a rebellious child, and running after his mother with a knife, he'd shoot the kid. Now, just because the baby's headed out, we can't touch the baby, all of a sudden, he's Kodesh Kadashim, you can't touch the baby because his life is just as important. Everyone's life is important, but when one life compromises the other, we're allowed to act preemptively. That's the halacha of Rodef. How come Rodef doesn't apply here? What do you think? What's the answer? What do you think? Excellent. Look at the last line. That would seem to be the answer of the Gemara. Shiny Hasan here is different. The Shemaya Karatzalei. Is the baby intentionally trying to pursue the mother? Of course not. In essence, Gemara refers to it euphemistically, heaven, and it's God in his infinite wisdom, which is at that point inscrutable, we don't exactly understand why such a tragedy would happen, but God in his infinite wisdom has decided that this delivery is going to compromise and risk, endanger the life of the mother. Not this poor baby. The baby wanted to kill the mother, okay? That's the halacha of Rodef. But here when it's coming from Shemayim, so then, you can't blame the baby for that. Therefore, we're not allowed to sacrifice the baby to save the mother. That is the Gemara's conclusion. Look at Rashi. Next page. Rashi says, on the case of the Isha, Shemach Shalele, this woman is having difficulty giving birth, Umasukenes, and she's in danger. So what's going on? So the key point is just the one-liner in Rashi. He says the following. What's the contrast that the baby's head has come out versus not? So what does Rashi say? To call the man shelo yotza la'avira olam. As long as the baby's body has not yet emerged into the air of the world, the baby is still entirely in utero. Lav nefesh hu. A very important Rashi. He says it very explicitly. As long as the baby is in utero, it's hard to know exactly how to translate nefesh. Obviously, doesn't mean soul here, but lav nefesh hu means at least it's not a fully endowed human being. And therefore, when nitin lahargo lahasilas imo, and therefore we're allowed to kill the baby in order to save the mother's life. Aval yasa rosha, but if the baby's head would emerge, then already it's a full-born child. The havale kiyolud, it's as if the baby was fully born once the head is out, or majority of the body is out, and then we can't touch the baby. But while the baby's in utero, says Rashi, lav nefeshu. So that explains a lot. One more Gemara, the Gemara actually here contrasts two verses. There's two different verses in the Chumash that talk about the prohibition of murder. Right? The Catholic Church thinks that abortion is murder. So, Gemara here discusses that. The Gemara says there's two different verses that talk about murder. One refers to it as make ish, if you will attack or kill an ish, a man. And then the other one in Bamidbar refers to make nefesh, which is also means a person, but it's a different choice of word. Just like we saw nefesh here. So the Gemara wants to know, why do we need both? Why in one case is it ish? Why in one case is it nefesh? So the Gemara proves two things from that. The first thing the Gemara explains is why we needed to have Make Nefesh, because if we only had the first one each, we might have reached one wrong conclusion. And then as the Gemara concludes, it switches it, and it says in the underlying part here, the Iksir Rahmana Kol Make Nefesh, but if the only verse in the Torah had just referred to Nefesh, I might have thought, I might have thought that even prohibits killing a fetus with the prohibition of murder. Or a filu ben shmona, someone who was born prematurely, tsricha, and therefore it's needed. So the question is, what is the implication of this Gemara? It's not saying that it's simply permissible. Is it saying, though, that it is not murder? Is it saying that it is murder? A little ambiguity from this Gemara as well. On the one hand, it sounds like a baby in utero would not be considered ish. Here, maybe it would be nefesh. Again, a little bit unclear. When it comes to the Rishonim, again, until now, the prohibition, again, let's think for a second. Has there been a source yet that explicitly told us that abortion, typical mother's 3 months pregnant, imagine whatever the reason, the motivation is you want, she decides she wants to go to Planned Parenthood, get an abortion. So has we seen yet a source that explicitly prohibits such a thing? We haven't seen that yet. So I'm Chumash. Yeah, so that's a good one. So whether that refers to fetuses is not a good question, but that also, and I should have used this as a caveat at the head of the share, thank you, Tali, is that I'm also not talking about what that person was talking about, which is non-Jews. Just to make it clear, we'll see this by implication or alluded to in other sources, but just so you should know, and I'm not getting into politics now, but just as a halachic fact, not only are non-Jews prohibited from performing abortions, it's a capital offense. They would be killed. So the Pope may not be totally wrong after all. At least for non-Jews, but that's a halacha. That is a halacha. But that's not, that pasuk is never used in the context of Jewish abortions. Someone once pointed out to me though, it doesn't really help because never all the doctors that perform this are Jewish. I'm sure that's an exaggeration, but only by slightly. Apparently, again, it's also a disproportionate. Maybe that's about the whole medical field. I don't know. But anyway, be that as it may. So the truth is that we haven't seen anything that's been really explicit. We've seen some implications. It sounds like it's only permissible when the mother's life's in danger. You don't necessarily think that it's a mitzvah other times. But it's not explicit. There are two main Rishonim that are quoted who make it clear, just in case you were confused, or not sure explicitly that abortion is prohibited. Again, unlike the woman from Hadassah, President, we actually do believe that it's not just some Christians, even Jews believe that abortion, at least in theory, in most cases, is prohibited. Absolutely. Where do we know that from? Who says it? So one is Tosfos. Tosfos is very interesting. Tali, it's a good segue from what I just said to you. Tosfos has a very interesting rationale. Look at Tosfos. Even though a non-Jew would be killed, it's a capital offense if they committed an abortion, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin itself says. Yisrael ain't no nerag, and it's clear that that's not true. That's the upshot of the previous Gemara. It's not true. It's not a capital offense. It's not punishable by death. If a Jew would have an abortion, he depater mikamokom lo shari, says Tosfos. There's no punishment of a capital nature. You're not going to kill someone who has an abortion. But that doesn't mean it's permissible. And in fact, as Tosfos in Maseches Nida makes more clear, actually it works off each other. Namely, there's a principle that many Rishonim subscribe to, that there won't be anything that a non-Jew is prohibited in that a Jew is allowed. We have a higher standard that builds on the Shevet Mitzvot Bnei Noach. It's not going to be a lower standard. Sometimes the punishment is different, as in this case, but it's not. So there's also uses exactly that argument. If it's prohibited for a non-Jew, of course that means it must be prohibited for a Jew. There's a third Tosfos in Maseches Nida that's a little bit unclear, which is debated in the poskim, but the consensus seems to be that Tosfos certainly, by extension, really everyone assumes without controversy that abortion would be prohibited. There's one final source to see in the earlier Rishonim, which you'll see right away. I think all of you will be clear why it's such a difficult source, and it really goes to the heart of many of the opinions, because a lot of the literature subsequently struggles to understand the opinion of the Rambam. And it's not just a central source because it's the Rambam, although obviously I think the Rambam becomes central to almost any topic he comments on. But I think you'll see that he speaks very profoundly, but also very cryptically. And we'll see if you can see what I mean in a moment. So look at the Rambam. Rambam is, again, it's also, where does the Rambam categorize this? Hilchos Rotzeach, the laws of murder. And here the Rambam describes the following fact. Harezu mitzvas losase, shlochos al nefesh harodef. Oh, remember we saw that from Sanhedrin. It's the same context, right? You shouldn't think that you're somehow a bleeding heart, sensitive person if you have mercy on the pursuer. On the contrary, it's a mitzvah not to have mercy on the pursuer, but to kill that person because you really want to save the intended victim. Lefichach, therefore, says the Rambam, Horu chachamim, sheha'ubra, shehi makshelele, a pregnant woman who's having difficulty, and again, it's a euphemism, it means her life is in danger because of the baby. Mutter lacho ha'ubar b'me'eha. You're allowed to, using that graphic example, you could literally, even if you had to, cut off the baby in her womb, or even b'me'eb'yad, you could either give her a drug or something that aborts the baby. Why? B'me'eshu k'rodeif achareha l'horga. Because he is, the baby is as if he, the rodeif, tried to kill the mother. Just like you could kill anybody else, you could even kill the baby. Now, one thing to know immediately is that that's not said anywhere. That's not what our Gemara said. Our Gemara only spoke about rodeif once the baby's head is already out. The Rambam introduces the fact of referring even to a baby fully in utero, on the one hand still not yet a full person anyway, as a rodeif. And therefore abortion is mutter to save the mother's life. However, the imisha hotzi rosho, once the baby's head comes out, ain no gimbo, then you can't touch the baby. Shein dochen nefesh, nefesh de nefesh. Aye, what happened to rodeif? Zehu tivo shalom, which most of you understand is the Rambam's synonymous phrase for, as David referred to before, min shemaya karat pele, when we said before, heaven is pursuing this mother. Here too, Rambam uses a different phrase with the same import. You can't blame the child. This is the way things are going. Who made nature? God. That's the synonymous phrase. So what is the problem with this Rambam? Literally, it's like on a dime. It's completely contradictory. When the baby is at a younger, or at least a more premature and less fully endowed stage, there the Rambam can call the baby a rodeif. The Gemara never did, but the Rambam does. But yeah, when the baby's head comes out, then you can't say the baby's a rodeif. That's tivo shel olam, that's the shemayim. So the answer, the question, of course, is obvious. It's the catch 22. If you say that you need intent to be considered a rodeif, so then how can you blame the baby when, whether it be 9 months or 3 months? When the baby's fully in utero, what, then the baby had intent? Of course not. But yet the Rambam calls that person, that baby a rodeif, and therefore wants her to have the abortion. But once the baby's head comes out, then all of a sudden he said, oh, don't blame the baby. Don't blame the baby. That's Hashem's will. It's mutually contradictory. You could probably write a book just on the amount of effort and time that's been spent trying to resolve this Rambam. It doesn't make sense on its face. It's a contradiction. And again, you can't blame it on the Gemara, because the Rambam got himself in trouble. Right? If the Rambam had just quoted the Gemara, he'd be fine. The Rambam didn't. The Rambam changed the Gemara. The Rambam added this idea of calling the baby in utero a rodeif. Now, how to resolve that is something that not only preoccupies in a more theoretical academic sense, but as we'll see even momentarily, some of the more machmir opinions on abortion use this Rambam very much as proof for them. Does everyone have the basic gist? The basic gist, really, one thing you need to know. It's confusing. All the rest is details. Right? The bottom line is we have many, many sources, not many, 5, 6, 7 sources in Mishnah and Gemara, which give us a somewhat clear but somewhat convoluted picture. It seems very clear that there's a difference in status between a fully born person or even partially born person and a completely in utero fetus. At the same time, that doesn't necessarily mean it's permissible, but if it's not permissible, then what's the prohibition? Is the prohibition murder? It didn't sound like that from the Pasuk and Chumash, which said if you accidentally kill a baby in utero, you only have to pay a fine. But if it's not murder, then what is it? Right? That's one thing for sure you don't get. That's a complete vacuum in contemporary culture, right? If you know, whether it be in America or Europe or Christian versus Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, right? In America, all they talk about is the two extremes. Either it's permissible, of course, or it's absolute murder because potential life is equal to life. So if we're going to reject those two extremes, so then what prohibition is it? That's not at all clear. And then, of course, you have the Rambam, who really just adds, you know, extra confusion to us, what's going on. Does everyone understand the basic facts? You got your building blocks. Your building blocks are, it's complicated. Okay? That's better than confusing. It's complicated. Okay. So there are three basic approaches. There's probably two other nuanced ones, but there's three well-known schools of thought among the post-school. Again, you have to understand here, just to make it clear, I don't want to pick on her, but it's her own fault. They all disagree with the president of Hadassah. Abortion is not a Jewish value. Anti-abortion is a Jewish value. It's prohibited. That's not the debate. The debate is, what is the prohibition? Of course, once we know the prohibition, then we may be in a better position to understand possible exceptions to the prohibition. But the first step is there a problem or not? The answer is yes. That seems to be clear. The debate is, what's the problem? So here we have three schools of thought, and you'll be surprised to know that the first school of thought, which we'll see has two main proponents, one of whom will be very well known to you, the other probably not, is not that different, if at all, from the Catholic Church. In Tavshin Chaf Gimel, how many years ago was that? 33 years ago? 43 years ago, thank you. 43 years ago, the then Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, or Isser Yehuda Unterman, now I'm guessing he's not so well known to everyone in the room, but he was a great, great Talmud Chacham, was one of the former chief rabbis of Israel, or Isser Yehuda Unterman, published an article. He published it in a journal called Noam, and it's also reprinted more or less in his volume of Chuvus called Shevet Miyehuda. Rav Unterman takes a very strong approach to this topic. If you look, it's an 11-page article. I cut it down to 6 paragraphs for you. He starts off by quoting an opinion of the Bahag. The Bahag says the following. You know, when the Gemara had said, if you recall, the Gemara had said, if a woman dies and she's pregnant, we'll eat Makal Shabbos in order to save that baby. So you know what the Bahag says? The Bahag says that would even be true, not if the mother was at the end or she had started labor and then died, which is what the Gemara's case was, even if it was the early part of pregnancy, even if it was before 40 days from her conception. We'd even Makal Shabbos in order to save that fetus. Now, I'm not going to be getting into, so I don't really want to confuse you, I'm sorry, there's only so much I can do in one shiur. I am not going to be getting into, at least not seriously, well, indirectly, now is the first example, dividing up the pregnancy into terms. In general, they speak about two other terms prior, obviously, to labor itself. One is the 40-day window, where not all, but some authorities are very, very lenient. And then we have a second line in the sand, which is 3 months, the first trimester. Where that comes from, who, again, would have to have a second shear for those details. But the point is, Rav Unterman is coming from the exact opposite extreme, and he has a source for it. That we even Mechal Shabbos for a baby right away. Not a baby, it's nothing at that point, less than 40 days. I were only Mechal Shabbos for Pikuach Nefesh. So Rav Unterman says, ooh, that's telling. Furthermore, if you look at the second paragraph here, what does he say from this? True, it's not a capital offense in Judaism. We don't kill someone who commits an abortion. It's hard to give a translation for the word Abizrayu. It's a term from the Gemara. Right, right. Maybe Eli's right. The best would be Yiddish. Shmek. A bit. It's a piece. It's part, right? In other contexts, they call it a cousin. But a first cousin, not like a distant cousin. They just see bar mitzvahs. It's part of the family of murder. Says Rav Unterman, abortion is prohibited because of ritzicha. It's not 100% the same kind of murder as if I would, God forbid, kill somebody in this room. That's why it's not a capital offense. But just don't get confused. Just because it's not a capital offense does not mean it's not murder. Rav Unterman is very, very adamant about this. He has a number of proofs, not only the earlier one. One of the things he proves from in that later in this paragraph is the Rambam. Why does the Rambam need to introduce the concept of rodeif? Says Rav Unterman, and Rav Moshe Feinstein will see momentarily, agrees with him. Because if it wouldn't be for the argument of rodeif, it would even be prohibited at the expense of the mother's life. Now, rodeif applies to a fully formed human being. If I went off to point a gun at you, I'd become a rodeif. You could kill me. I am fully human. I have all sanctity of life. So the Rambam says Rav Unterman, that's why the Rambam needed rodeif. Because apparently, even the baby would be protected completely, even if it meant the expense of the mother's life, except for the fact that we determine that the baby, at least in utero, is considered a rodeif. Why all of a sudden that changes when the baby's head comes out, that's obviously more complicated. But the fact that the Rambam introduces rodeif for a baby fully in utero, what do you need it for? Says Rav Unterman, only because it would have been prohibited even at the expense of the life of the mother. Because it's ritzicha, it's murder. It's just that when the murderer would otherwise have been a rodeif, you're allowed to murder somebody. But it is murder. That's what Unterman says. He repeats this numerous times. And then he adds the following, which is really fascinating. He just, towards the end of the right-hand column here, he even talks about the fact that even if there will be terrible birth defects, for example, that is prohibited. Even if they think there's a likelihood that there's problems, certainly that's prohibited. He's very, very upset about this. In fact, he mentions, if you look at the end of the right-hand paragraph, the whole idea of perhaps aborting, he's talking, of course, about thalidomide there. The whole fact that someone might abort because they think they're going to have a deformed child, says a bunch of them that not only is it prohibited, last line, kol etzem ha-machshava hazot nirisli, k'menugedes et hashkaf satara kdosha. It's completely antithetical to a Jewish way of thinking. The idea that anyone who is, that a deformed child has any less sanctity of life and therefore protection, deserving of protection, any less than a fully formed human being, says the idea of aborting under such, even under such extreme circumstances, let alone just because you think you mean it to get pregnant, even under such extreme circumstances, accidentally the doctor gives you the tranquilizer that they thought was innocuous and now it's going to have gross test deformities, says Rabbi Zerman, it's not only prohibited, it's the best thing you can say about it is it's prohibited. It's worse than prohibited. It's antithetical to Judaism. Why look at the top left-hand paragraph? And here I'm telling you, it could be the Pope. Look what he says. He's very profound. He says, I mean, I'm not saying he's right, but very, very powerful stuff. Second line, ki bikuach nefesh, when it comes to matters of saving life, onu donim gam al shah asid. We don't just look at the here and now, we look at future potential. Lios bleep ula nosefes. If we would just let nature take its course, we can't that even in the present. Afidarko shel olam, avshadayin enu b'kol v'mesiyos, even though right now this baby is only a glob of cells in utero, but kevesh hakayemes chazaka, since the presumption is the rov nashim, lad ma'ayil yodan, but most cases if you let nature take its course, this clump of cells will turn into a fully formed being, which will then be born without problems. Haria ha'ubar shebamaya isha mitchilas mitziyusa. This fetus, even from the most early stages of its existence, nechshav kfar ka'adam she'oser lifgav b'chayav. It already has the status of potential life, which, according to Rav Unterman, is essentially tantamount and equivalent to actual life. Na'achas shehu omed liyoskein, because the future will be. So we already look at it as having independent life. The potential of the life is already granted essentially equal status to actual life. He tells an incredible story here because he asks the question, and this really should be what's on your mind. If it's really murder, is it Yaharik Bal Yavor? Do you have to let yourself be killed rather than violate it? Which is what we do say the halacha is when it comes to other murder cases. So he says it's a real case. What was the Shiloh? It was a case of a Nazi who forcibly had his way with a Jewish girl, and then she became pregnant. That's the last thing the Nazi wanted, a Jewish baby. So he grabs her and drags her to a doctor who was also Jewish and from, and wanted to force her and the doctor that she should have an abortion. The doctor wasn't sure he was allowed to do such an abortion. So he begged off, he needed a day to decide. And he went and asked his rabbi, am I allowed to have such an abortion? Because otherwise, it says here, and he says the case, of course, the Nazi already put a gun to his head. On that one question, Rav Unterman is mekel. He says, you don't have to die rather than perform an abortion. It's not Yaharik Bal Yavor. Not because it's not Ratzicha, but he says, technically, since it's not the type of Ratzicha that's explicitly mentioned in the Chumash, it's only in Abizrai, it was only a type of Ratzicha, it's a Shmech Ratzicha. So says Rav Unterman, you only have to die to not violate something that's Allah hamafurish bakra, that's explicit in the Chumash, but which regular murder is. But this cousin of murder, that you don't have to die for. But otherwise, potential life, he repeats this idea in the last paragraph, he talks about the asbakalaria shalasti, this whole approach, this attitude of looking at the future, potential life, he says Judaism fully embraces, not just the Catholic Church. And that is the mantra of the Catholic Church. Rav Unterman says we embrace it. So you'll say, okay, Rav Unterman's a nice rabbi, but who's Rav Unterman? Okay. With all the respect, maybe Rav Moshe Feinstein says the same thing. This I do not think is so well known. Turn over the page. Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva. We'll come back to this tshuva subsequently. The tshuva from Tavshin Lamed Zion. End of Sukkot. Says Rav Moshe, first line, the Oser B'Pshitus B'Isser Ritzicha. Abortion is a type of murder. And he quotes the argument that if it would be considered murder for a non-Jew, which is why they're killed for it, it can't be any less severe for us. Even though we're allowed to do it to save the life of the mother, that's okay. And what's one of his proofs? The Rambam. Like Rav Unterman. Four lines down, the Rambam says, that you need the whole idea of rodeth, says Rav Moshe, by the Rambam referring to a fetus as a rodeth, that by definition means that it was only permissible to kill them. That means it's considered ritzicha. It may be permissible ritzicha, but it's considered ritzicha. He repeats it in the next line. Hari desover da'av shapater hu al kaponim linyan ha'isr. In such a case, to save the mother's life is permissible. But theoretically, if it would be permissible, what's the violation? Ha'isr kiritzicha mamish. If you go down midway through, he quotes Rashi. It's Iker Isser Ritzicha Milo Sirtzach. He includes it in the Pasuk, the Asaras Adibros, Lo Sirtzach, thou shalt not kill. Gam Hala Uber. Right? So just a technical caveat, Shapater Haharga Mimisa. We don't kill such an offender. It's not a capital offense, but that's only a technicality. But otherwise, in the full moral sense of it, the gravity of it is considered murder. And therefore, he says, I askin, we tam zohrisi, sh'av sh'harofim omer m'shesh chashash, Shema Thomas, if the doctor will say maybe such a baby will die, excuse me, Thomas Aim, if the doctor say, you know, if you let the pregnancy go to term, maybe the mother's life will be in danger. Ramosha said in such a case, since it's only a maybe that the mother will die, but maybe the mother will die, we're not going to definitely kill the baby. Only says the Ramosha, Ad shitiha umdin al harokim kidzola karob lavadai, until the doctors can tell us that it's almost a certainty that the mother will die, then only then did Moshe allow an abortion. But less than that, Moshe didn't allow. And getting back to something which we hope to get back to in a few minutes, towards the end of this year, Moshe here introduces the concept of even the most extreme case you could think of, Tay-Sachs. So if you can confirm that the baby has Tay-Sachs, so you know that with a medical certainty the baby will probably not make it to the age of 4. Not only will the baby have only short life, the baby's life will be horribly painful, and the emotional pain for the parents is going to be overwhelming. Says Rav Moshe, 100% usher to abort a Texas baby. Because we're not playing with a little nothing. We're talking about Ritzicha. You can't kill somebody because in 4 years they're going to die. If it would be a fully formed person like that, let me ask you this, what if the baby's already born? That's what's called infanticide. Then we would kill you. That's a capital crime. So maybe we're not going to have the death penalty if you do it right before the baby's born, but the severity of it, Ritzicha, says Rav Moshe, 100%. Now, the truth is, there's some very strong argumentation here. They speak with tremendous passion about Rav Moshe and Rav Unterman, but it's also true that this is not the majority opinion. But it's an important minority opinion to be aware of. So what are the others, if they don't hold the Tzitzicha, what do the other opinions say? So there's two other approaches. If you look at the bottom of the sheet, you have Rav Yair Bachrach. Rav Yair Bachrach was a great, great Rav. Germany, Amsterdam, people ask themselves, the great, great Rav, 300-400 years ago. Fascinating piece of trivia. Chavos Yair, where does that come from? So first of all, it comes from Pasuk in Tanakh. I just learned with my daughter. But why did he pick the name Chavos Yair? It's in part because he had, I think it's his mother or grandmother, whose name was Chava, who was very, very learned and was one of his primary rabbis. So in order to give a testimony to his very learned female relative, so he included her name, Chavos, in the name of the Sefer. I just find that cute. Okay. So, he's not the only one, by the way, either. There's at least one or two other examples I know of in similar ways. So the Chavos... Right, well, that's Tzion L'Nefesh Chaya. Right, good. So look at the Chavos Yair. He has the following case. I'll paraphrase the question. A Jewish woman has an adulterous affair. Many of these Shilas and Poskim came from such cases where people had affairs and then they were pregnant. And this is a big problem. Uh-oh. So in his case, the regret is unbelievable. He writes how the woman feels terribly guilty, very sincere about it. She's like even banging her head against the wall. Literally, she's so overwhelmed and overcome with grief. And the thought of carrying this baby to term is like driving her to a wit's end. Are you allowed to have such an abortion in the case? So he points out, some will seem momentarily maybe debatable, he says, the graphic nature or the salacious nature of the case, notwithstanding, this is no better or worse than any other case. Whether it be a married woman with her husband getting pregnant, or a single woman, which is certainly not a nice way for a nice Jewish girl to behave, but not a capital offense, which adultery is in this case. Says the commentary, it doesn't matter what the case is. The bottom line is, you're asking me a question. Are you allowed to have an abortion or not? Says Chavos Yair, the answer is no. You're not allowed to have an abortion. The mother's life's not in danger, necessarily. So, why is it prohibited? He says it's not murder. He has a very, very creative, perhaps somewhat surprising theory. If you look what he says here, turn over the page. There's plenty more here for you to read, but for the sake of time, I'm going to skip that. You can follow my underlines if you're looking for other good things to read. Bottom line, I'm skipping a lot for the sake of time. Bottom lines, look at the last part where I have an underline. What does he say? It's a prohibition, get this, of motzi zera levatala, wasting the male seed. We discussed that topic, it's that last week. Meaning, says the Kavos Yair, that even, basically the definition of that prohibition is any unnatural interruption of what would otherwise be the natural process. Now, of course, the likelihood is, right, we know there are millions of little sperm, and the likelihood is that in most cases, none of them, right, hit up with the egg. And even in cases where the woman becomes pregnant, only one of them did. Right? Even two, you'd have twins. Right? From that millions of little sperm. It doesn't matter that the odds are infinitesimal. It doesn't matter. That's nature taking its course. In any way that nature is interrupted unnaturally, artificially, that is already considered that violation. Ah, you'll say, is that a prohibition on men? So he quotes Tosfos and says, no, if women are involved, it's also a prohibition on them. And you can throw in the doctor, perhaps, too. So, that's a series of error, but it certainly doesn't come close to murder. It's a way step down from Moshe Feinstein. So that leaves open more flexibility, but in theory, also still prohibited. That's the nature of prohibition. And many people quote this. At least one agrees with it. If you look in the next sources, Rav Yaakov Emden has a tshuva. So he says a more sensational, very controversial leniency. He says you can distinguish between the otherwise, if you will, quote, good Jewish girl and the woman who had the affair, based on which Gemara that we saw together earlier? The Gemara in Erechet. What are the Gemara in Erechet today? If a woman is being taken out to be killed for a capital offense, we essentially look at that baby as ready, who's going to die anyway, and then we'll even abort the baby earlier to save her pride. So says of Yaakov Emden, even though we can't carry out the death penalty now, she had an adulterous affair. She's chayav misa, which means in essence the baby should be killed also. So therefore, in such a case, Rav Yaakov Emden is willing to be much more lenient. He suggests there might even be a mitzvah to abort in such a case. Especially if you can help the mother in the marriage, whatever. That distinction is very controversial. Many others, not surprisingly, Moshe Feinstein, don't like that at all. But be that as it may, on the basic premise, he agrees with the Chavos Yair that that is the prohibition. That's school of thought number two. And perhaps the most widely accepted view is school of thought number three. And the one who first originated this is known as the Maharit, Yeshua the Trani. And he has two tshuvas here. The first one is Chelek Aleph in Tzadi Tes, chapter 99, where there, I just gave you a little bit, but again, for the sake of time, I'll leave out the details. There, he basically makes the point, 100% is not murder. The first thing he says is, again, he lived well before Moshe Feinstein, but in essence he's saying, Moshe Feinstein is definitely wrong, abortion is definitely not murder, potential life should not at all be confused with natural life, as he puts it as, there's not even a nidnud, there's not even a little bit, there's not even a shmek of any ibud nefesh, that maybe the fetus is not a nefesh, and therefore definitely not. So therefore, is it okay? No, he says, last line in the bottom source, what is it? Tahada asr, midin chavalahu. This is so fascinating in light of contemporary American and Western cultural debate. What does chavala mean? Chavala means your bodily injury. So what is, again, so the point is, unlike the general premise in the pro-choice argument, self-inflicted bodily injury is prohibited according to Jewish law. The argument that, well, just a part of the mother's body and therefore she can do whatever she wants, according to Maharit, is only half true. The first part of the statement is true. Apparently, uber yerech limo, the fetus is considered part of the mother's body. But who said you have to destroy that part of the body? On the contrary, that's an iser, perhaps the oraisa, of chavala. You're not allowed to inflict a wound on your body. It's very fascinating in light of the way the contemporary debate has emerged. Because he would not say that they're entirely wrong, but they're just wrong on the main point. Which is, yes, it's maybe part of your body. But this is, again, this is a very profound point in terms of our general debate with Western society. We are not the balabatim on our own bodies. That is a major, major premise of Jewish thought. We are custodians of our bodies. They're gifts from God. Therefore, we have to use them in a certain way. But to just wantonly destroy part of our body, we're not allowed to do that. Whether it would be our arm or our fetus. Right? It's a prohibition to self-inflict a wound, even in a minor level, let alone to abort a fetus. That, says the Maharit, is a prohibition. So now, We have about 10 more minutes to go. I want to discuss with that background. Again, obviously, there's so much more we could do on every one of these opinions. As I said, I'm not even getting into the issues of 40 days versus 3 months versus there's so much there. But we have the basic building blocks. If you ever, pretty much you can go anywhere now when you're already an expert. You've seen the basic primary sources from Chumash, Mishnah, and Gemara. You know about the famous Rambam. If you ever want to stop someone, ask them how they figure out that Rambam. There are answers, but I didn't even have a chance to go into them with you. There are answers to that Rambam. And you've seen the basic three opinions. You have a minority opinion that says it's murder, or some variation of it, Rabbi Feinstein and Rav Unterman. You have the idea of Motzi Zera Batala, wasting the male seed. The middle opinion, and then you have the third opinion, which I would guess is most likely the predominant view, and that is that true, on some level we view the fetus as part of the mother's body, but that itself is prohibited and allowed to wantonly destroy part of one's body. So I just want to end with a few examples of heterim for abortion. Until now we've only focused on the prohibition, and that's for a reason, because abortion from a Jewish perspective is prohibited, and that has to be the Aleph, Beis, and Gimel of the discussion. And again, what drives me insane, whether it's this woman from the president of Hadassah or others, I'm telling you, there's so many examples. I have an antenna for this. I pick up these things of projections in the media, in the popular press, etc., that, well, Catholics are against abortion, Jews are pro-choice. Again, I'm not talking about the political considerations. That's a separate issue and it's complicated. I mean, in principle, philosophically, ideologically, chas v'shalom, there's nothing to be further from the truth. Well, not at all. We think abortion is absolutely prohibited. What? The prohibition? Oh, so now we can talk. Is this, is it that? Now, why is it this or is it that important? Because then we want to know if and when there are exceptions. And obviously, without getting into too many details, but the more severe you hold the prohibition, the more restrictive you're going to be on what the possible exceptions are. So if you hold, as Rav Moshe Feinstein, for example, that it's murder, there's going to be very few, if any, exceptions other than perhaps the life of the mother. But if you hold that it's one of the lesser prohibitions, so you're not going to say, just do it because, unfortunately, you're ready to get on with your career, and the baby will be inconvenient. Right? That, you're not going to find too many heterim for that in Jewish faith. But let's say there's something more extenuating. So let me give you an example. What would be something more extenuating? What about if the life of the mother is going to be absolutely protected here? That's not at risk. But the health of the mother is at risk. What about the psychological health of the mother? Is that permissible? What about if there will be terrible deformities to the baby? What about a Tay-Sachs case? Where you know anyway the baby's not even going to really live. Is that permissible? So depending on what you start, they're all starting at the same starting point. Right? If you will, you'll indulge the analogy, it's like at one of these Olympic races. So we're all at the same starting point, usser. But you have different starting positions. Depending on what your starting position is it also because of murder? Is it also because of bodily injury, chavala? Well, depending on where your starting position is, you may come to a different conclusion on some of the other cases that come around. So I just, again, literally, there have been books literally written on this, and if you go back to the first page, I gave you 5 or 6 all pretty accessible articles in books if you want to do further research. But there's, literally, we could just write a book just on this part of the shir. What are the exceptions over history that folks can have given that have allowed abortion? And there certainly are examples of that. So I want to give you just a few examples. So the top of this sheet is the Tshuvos Mishpatei Uziel. Rav Uziel was one of the Sephardic chief rabbis of Israel. Again, after post-establishment of the state, not that long ago. Rav Uziel was asked the question, if you look at the top lines, the woman is Sovelas B'michush Shabaznao. She has some type of hearing defect. And the doctors told her that after her pregnancy, when she got pregnant, the doctors say that if she will continue with the pregnancy, she'll go completely deaf in both ears. I have no idea what the condition was. Don't ask me for the medical background. That's the shiloh. So what would you say, what do you think Rav Moshe Feinstein would say if you asked him the shiloh? Oh, sir! Right? You're not allowed to commit murder to prevent someone from being deaf. Rav Uziel is lenient. In that case, Rav Uziel allowed an abortion. And he has the proof, he says, from other poskims as well. Yet, it's not permissible for nothing. But we see, for example, as he says from the Gemara Sefer Erechin, where we're going to even abort a baby just so that the woman should not have the added embarrassment of after she's been killed, then the baby coming out, and that would embarrass her. So as Rav Uziel calls it, that's a tam kolosh. That's a very weak reason. To prevent deafness is a lot greater of reason. Now, the counter argument against that was, in that case, anyway, the baby was going to die shortly. So, how do you weigh those two things? So Rav Uziel says, you see if there's any great need, even if it's not the same level of life, even much more lenient than that. Even if there's a great need, it's permissible, and he defines, in this case, a great need as preventing deafness. Many, many other examples. I'll tell you the following story. This is a true story. I have two true stories to tell you as we finish up this year. I mentioned the German measles epidemic in the 60s. So there was a case of, at the time, a very prominent American shulrav, whose wife, I don't know if she contracted it, she was exposed to it, I don't know the details, but she had great fears that because of the German measles, she would be carrying this very deformed baby. She went to her Soloveitchik, and she asked him if she's allowed to have an abortion. And he wouldn't answer her. He sent her to his brother, Avraham Soloveitchik. Now, we still don't know what he thought was going to happen by going to Avraham. But bottom line, I heard this story, I know this story from Avraham's grandson. So that, in the family, that's a sore point. But anyway, he sent her to the family, the couple, to the brother, Avraham Soloveitchik, in Chicago. And Avraham listened and listened, and he basically said, listen, I feel for you, it's terrible, but I can't allow an abortion. Again, they probably come from the Rambam school, maybe they think it's Ratzicha, I'm not sure. That's not clear from the story, but they didn't allow the abortion again, despite the fear of these horrible deformities, which thousands of children, in fact, the P.S., despite whatever the risk factors were, there was a reason that they were scared, the baby was born fully healthy, is now a significant Talmud Chacham who has published numerous books, some which are in my library. That's the baby who would have been aborted had either of them allowed it. So, this is not a simple thing. This is not a simple thing when you're talking about, well, the baby may be this, the baby may be that. Not a simple thing. Now, I'll tell you a second story. It's a chavrusa of mine. That story I'm telling you, I have good sources on it, but predates my birth. It's in the early 60s. Not that long ago. My daughter may have already been born. Was that around that same year? I had a chavrusa. My chavrusa, a nice tarvadas bacher, before he got to YU, had a high school sweetheart. That wasn't so nice from the Torah V'Daf perspective. But anyway, be that as it or the Beis Yaakov perspective. But they survived it all, and in fact, they were now a wonderful married couple. The problem is, they were childhood sweethearts. So, before they got married, somebody probably told them, go get a blood test. Guess what they found out? They were both Tay-Sachs carriers. Their rabbi at the time, who ended up, if I'm not mistaken, I think he was Musar HaKadushin, before the story actually takes place, pleaded with them to break up. And our other poskim, including one of them I have on the sheet, who writes he thinks it's usher for a couple that in such a situation. If not usher, it might be too strong a word, but very against couples like that getting married. They were high school sweethearts. It wasn't like a 2-month, 8-day courtship. That's very long now, I know, but they were high school sweethearts. It wasn't happening. They went through with it. They went through with it. So then, while I'm now Chavrus is with him, she's expecting her first child. They can barely breathe, they're so nervous. They go to get the Tay-Sachs test. Catch this. No signs of Tay-Sachs, but they do find another horrible, horrible abnormality and deformity. Like, what are the odds? Not necessarily life-threatening, but, I mean, grotesque stuff. So they are completely besides themselves. And they ask of Shaila, are they allowed to get an abortion? In the meantime, I forget exactly the details. You know, OBGYN here maybe would know better. They take a second test, not just because it's better to take two tests rather than one, because the first test, I believe, only is testing the amniotic fluid, if I'm not mistaken, and the second test perhaps would be taking something from the baby itself, because again, it has to do with the way the egg splits. 90-something percent of the time, maybe 99% of the time, the DNA in one is the same as the one in the other, but they all come from the same place. But there is some very, very, very small possibility that even though disease X could be placenta and the fluid, it may not necessarily actually be in the baby. As it so happens, that's what happened in this case. The baby was fine. So they now have 3 or 4 children, and Kenai Nahara, they're playing Russian roulette. Tay-Sachs is 1 in 4. if you have two, if you have both parents are carriers, all of the children are fine. They now live in Eretz Yisrael. He's a Rebbe and a very popular American Jew, where some of you may have children, but I'm not going to tell you, obviously, who this person is. Wonderful, wonderful people. So I tell you these stories just to give you the following introduction. Perhaps one of the most heated, passionate debates of the last some odd years, 25, 30 years, was a debate between Moshe Feinstein and Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, otherwise known as the Tzitz Eliezer. You may recall those names because they had a passionate debate last week. Moshe was lenient on what we call AID, even non-Jewish donor sperm. And Tzitz Eliezer went nuts. How can you do this? You're ruining the Jewish family. Terrible. So now the shoe's on the other foot. We saw Moshe's general disposition, right? I'm not going to have to, but I gave you a little bit. You can read it inside if you like on the bottom of this second to last page. Have you tshuva from Rav Tzitz Eliezer? Tzitz Eliezer basically makes the following argument. He discusses, not that we need to be reminded of the horrible nature of Tzitzak, how terrible it is for the child. You can only imagine how terrible this would be for the parents. There's a catch. Tzitzak, apparently, I don't know if this has changed, but certainly Rav Tzitz was true. It can only be confirmed with certainty with an amniocentesis, which takes place already at the end of the second trimester. This is the again, I don't know what the details are now, but this was the premise of his tshuva. Says Tzitz Eliezer, until the mother is 6 months, fully complete 6 months, meaning until she finishes her second trimester, in the case of Tzitzak, he allows abortions. If you have a baby who, I mean, you can feel the kicking already. 4 months, 5 months, I mean, the mother's obviously showing. Tzitz Eliezer allows abortion in such a case. As he said again, his language is very emotional, very powerful. He speaks about other poskim. We just mentioned the Uziel before, and there's a tzorach gadol, a great need. So he says here, imkein hagav asaf, think for yourself. Im yesh tzorach sa'ar v'keiv yoser gadol mizeh? Is there any greater need? Is there any greater pain for a family than this case? For a mother who's going to have to give birth to a child such as this, it's going to be horribly painful, terrible few years with a definite death. The parents are crying, they're looking to Hashem for some kind of a salvation. How are they going to have to be able to do this? And therefore he says here, Niru Dizehua Mikra HaKlasi Yoter Shishan Haji. This is the classical case that says the other should be able to be lenient. It doesn't matter what the case is, it doesn't matter if it's physical pain for the mother, or deafness, or emotional pain. Emotional pain may even be worse than the physical pain, and therefore he allows it without a doubt. You turn over to the last page. We have Rav Moshe Feinstein. This piece from Rav Moshe Feinstein comes from the end of the tshuva we saw before. It's a very, very long tshuva. What did Rav Moshe's position was? Rav Moshe's position was it's murder. So Rav Moshe has a very lengthy, emotionally charged tshuva. And then he writes at the end, Ketav Yikol Zeh, why did I write so much, so powerfully? Linyan HaPirtza HaGadola Ba'olam, the tremendous breach in the Jewish world which is taking place. Why? Shamachius the Harbe Medinos, he's already pressing against Roe v. Wade. So many, including, he says, Israel and America, so many governments are allowing abortion upon demand, which again, according to Moshe, is murder. It's a terrible, terrible thing. And not only that, Lachain, third line, Nishtomamti, I was astounded, dumbfounded, Berosi Tshuva, Mechacham Echad Beretzol, he won't even call him by name. I saw a Tshuva from a certain Chacham, quote unquote, from Israel, he's referring to our Tzitz Eliezer. That was a tshuva that Tzitz Eliezer wrote to the chief of medicine at Shari Tzedek. The Nidbeg, it's very been published in a journal. Hamater Holadas Shal Yidei Bechinos Harofim Kishu Uber Yoser Megimul Chadashim. Even though it's been after 3 months, Shauber who already is moving, etc. Umitzad Zehikdim Sheesem Harigas Uberim Habel Harbe Posim Rakman Rabbanon. This is as well. Maybe it's not such a big problem. If it's Daraisa, it doesn't matter, etc., etc. Lachain masik lahatir betesex. You see that right after I have it underlined. You see how they spell tesex? Tough you do it. Dash samach kuf samach. He allowed an abortion in the case of a tesex lahabir ad shiva chadashim. After 7 months, even though the other does not allow it. Once you're in the third trimester, he doesn't even allow that. But even till the end of this first trimester, He does allow it. Ubar upashut kirkasavti, says Rav Moshe. It's clear. Halacha brua. Alpi Rav Hussein harishan of Afarshim haposkim mamish. She'osr betin retzicha. Kol uber. Bein kosher, bein mamzer, bein stam ubrim, bein hayiduim, lecholi, takes acts. What, someone who has taste acts is any less, is deserving of any less protection than a child who's healthy? She'kulan asurin midina mamish. They're all 100% prohibited. Bein litos. You should not be mistaken. Don't rely on this person. It's really painful, but that's the truth of Rav Moshe. So you have literally two opposite extremes. There you have a case, the mother's life is not in danger, her physical health is not in danger. You could argue that her emotional well-being is in danger, but being emotionally well, you know, depressed or other things is not necessarily the same thing as suicidal or other things. There's obviously a range. Right? The human being is surprisingly resilient. So you have to be very careful. It's a very slippery slope when you say, well, it would be a terrible thing to have a deformed child, or even a child that has terminal disease. It would obviously be terrible. No one, including Rav Moshe, would be belittling how terrible a tragedy that would be. But you're not talking about any danger of life for the mother necessarily, or any, and yet, what do? It's a horrible, horrible tragedy. Now, it should be noted, in a case, this was asked to Rav Moshe himself, where the fear was that the woman, because of whatever her issues were, she had to get off medication, was pregnant, that she'd be suicidal, Rav Moshe himself allowed an abortion. Sorry? Because then, even though it's an emotional, not it's a psychological health, not the physical, but so Rav Moshe says that's tantamount to her life being in danger, like any, that's the classic Rambam, that's the classic Mishnah and all those. But the point is, short of that, and again, just being depressed is not the same thing as that, short of that, Rav Moshe held it's even murder, absolute murder, and it won't allow, even in the most extreme of cases, like Pesach. Rav Waldenberg is on the whole other extreme. He's allowing it even until the end of the 6 months. And then you have many in between. What's in between? In between is other types of problems. Whether it's other problems, deformities for the child, other types of problems, the deafness or other cases. Oh, I know another case. I just, Rabbi Tzvi Shor from Jewish Hospice on Friday, I asked him if he knew about this. He says, not only did I know about this, it was a Baltimore case. Well, before my arrival, I don't remember the name, so I can't even tell you. But there's a Shiloh that was asked. There was a woman, he says it was a young married woman in Baltimore. She had lung cancer. And she got pregnant. And apparently the hormones and other things, the cancer is much, much more aggressive once you're pregnant. And she had a pretty terminal case to begin with. She probably was going to die anyway, but she would have died much quicker if she kept the baby. And her Moshe Feinstein mounted that abortion in that case. Because even though it's only temporary life, it's known as Chayei Sha'ah, that's the life. So if it's the life of the mother, that Rav Moshe was willing to make on. But again, the cases are so emotionally charged. Can you imagine that case? They went, right? The one mother, she had German measles. Who knows what she's fearing? Can you imagine? You could argue, that certainly for the rabbi, the easier psak would have been to say, yes, have the abortion. But then I wouldn't have the sfarim in my shelf at home. I'm not just talking about my shelf, so you understand I'm using it as a metaphor. They're so powerful, so emotionally charged, and you really have a range of views, not only what the problem is, and that's of course going to affect what stage, I didn't even get into it, as I said, what stage of pregnancy we're talking about, right? The whole morning after pill question, very, very relevant, obviously. What's the problem? Is it the problem with the mother, the problem with the baby? Many, many, many possibilities. Again, on the one hand, this is an ancient Shiloh. On the other hand, even as an ancient Shiloh, modern technology, etc., has created some solutions, but also many more problems that need to be constantly faced and reevaluated by Rabbanim. And Yemirat Hashem, with these building blocks that we have, for whether it's the Mishnah and Gemara or Chumash, let alone the earlier poskim, so we are, unfortunately, there's no such case that could ever be asked in this context as anything but a tragedy. That's one guarantee. Any child in this parsha is a tragedy. But how you'll resolve that tragedy and what etc., that is something that obviously Rabbanim have to weigh very, very carefully. You would think that these things don't happen too often. They don't, they're not such common shilas, But as I told you, even in my little circle, I know of one and specifically was involved indirectly because I was the only other person other than the Rabbanim and the doctors who knew. Even the parents, they didn't tell because they didn't want to worry them unnecessarily, which as it turned out was a good decision because there was nothing to tell. The baby was born and fine. But there are shilas where this comes up, and hopefully we have a little bit of a better appreciation of what our approach to these things are. Just as a programming note, next week we'll conclude the series that we'll catch home, and there I want to discuss, moving to the end of, well, not the beginning of life, but the end, to discuss the major, major, major debate which has occupied Rabbanim for many, many years now, probably to be not fully resolved ever, which is how do we define the end of life? Cessation of breathing, mental capacity, brainstem. Obviously, these are shallows that doctors deal with on a daily basis. Unfortunately, now when people are at end stage, respirators, not respirators, organ transplants. I mean, these are major, major shallows. We won't be able to discuss them all, but on the basic question of we discuss when life begins, we discuss that status of potential life, and Mr. Shem will discuss as we conclude the series, determining the end of life. A question, and then we'll, I guess, go into dessert. Yes. It says your house.